Mosquito.
Good evening.
Mr. Bone.
Yes.
This is Matthew Lunner at the Vietnam Archives.
Hi, Matthew. Can you talk a little louder?
Certainly, sir. Are you ready for... Can I hear you?
Right, I certainly am.
Okay. Just for formality's sake, we say that you're aware that I'm recording this conversation for use of the students in Dr. Rector's Vietnam class.
Okay, for formality, I realize you're recording this for the use of the students.
Okay. Of course, I will get a copy of this to you, as well as we will retain a copy here.
And also a copy of the transcript.
Yes, sir.
Matthew, may I call you Matthew?
Certainly, certainly, sir.
One of the things that, you know, I'm looking up... UDT Seal.
Yes, sir.
And I guess you have a group there. How many people do you have there?
Well, actually, they have all given me their questions because they are in the process of... one is at work and one is doing something else, but I have an extensive list of questions, so I will be conducting the interview by myself right now.
Okay. You started off with... you wanted something on the training.
Yes, sir.
In the late 50s and the 60s.
Yes, sir. I'll have some questions specifically related to that, a couple different questions, then some questions specifically relating to how SEALs were used in Vietnam and the views of you as commander and whatnot.
And you also want to know, well, if you're talking about in the 60s, what we're doing is talking about the training and also when we first started operating.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I also have a little thing in there I could give you on this. How long is this interview going to be?
I would imagine it will be as long as it takes, maybe 45 minutes, maybe an hour, depending on how long we want to go, how long an answer you want to give. It really depends.
Can you ask me the question?
Okay, just for...
Well, there's another way out of this thing is that I can go ahead and give you, about the training, bus training, or nature training, or what we did. I'll take and fill your training. Go ahead.
Okay.
Your question.
All right.
Otherwise, I can give you the whole thing. However, when you're starting to talk about Vietnam, you have to go back to 60.
Yes, sir.
And I have a prelude to Vietnam, which is one of the things that meant that put us in there, which you probably have not read and have not found in your history book. If you're interested, I'll give you that.
Well, certainly, sir. We'll be interested.
I need to wait for my book to come out.
Well, I'm sure that as soon as your book comes out, I will order a copy of it to the archive here.
All right.
I am with Roy Bone, former commander of SEAL Team 1. SEAL Team 2. Excuse me. I'm terribly sorry. It is April 17th at 3:30 in the afternoon, Central Standard Time. Mr. Bohm is at his home in Punta Gorda, Florida. Speaking of training, Mr. Bohm, SEAL training had a reputation for being much more intense and difficult and demanding than any other training in the military. What was the reason behind putting SEALs through such rigorous training?
Well, let's learn that first. We were not trying to get these men to graduate. My class alone started with 140-some-odd people, graduated 21, 14 enlisted men and 7 officers. Let me tell you about how the people were selected.
Certainly.
For SEAL. Personnel selected from volunteers from the fleet. No one arbitrarily ordered to UDT in UDTs or SEAL.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first thing. They are all volunteers. There's a high degree of desire for UDT SEAL duty, willing to withstand the rigors of FUD physical, which is basic underwater demolition training, physical, psychological, lengthy training. This is 16 weeks. Those that display the never give up characteristics and bond with a team unity, you know, teammates, with a team action. You didn't get through by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You got through because you were a team. And if you didn't have that, you didn't make it. And another thing, you had to want that more than anything in this world in order to make it. Yeah. With the people after they get in, we have a high reenlistment ratio compared to the fleet sailors. We have a retention of qualified SEALs with their expensive training. And some spend an entire Navy career in a team. Some 20-year Navy careers, up to 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
The 1950s and 60s, morale and training operations and leadership were at a peak. Innovations of the new equipment, expanded mission, operational commitment, worldwide giving personnel an all-round experience was an exciting thing. Accomplishment and history of the actual combat of this closely knit group speaks for itself.
Mm-hmm.
We consider it to be the elite of the military. This is one of the things, one of the reasons about this. Now, with the training itself, basically, what we were trying to do was mold a unit. We wanted to find out, is this guy a loner? Is he a hot shot? Is he going to pick up the pieces? Is he going to support it? Is he all out for the team? Because no man is an island to himself, especially in this type of organization that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can make a man quit, let's do so. It's better to have him quit in training than it is in the field. And this is basically what we did. So we weren't trying to get them in training. We were trying to really run them out. And what we had left over, we knew would go the whole route. Now you say, what's the difference between then and the 60s later on? To answer your question there is that as the training went on, we smartened up. For the simple reason that when you get a man drug-free, dedicated, to volunteer in the first place, and then should he, in the old days, if you broke your leg, you were out. Or if you hurt yourself, you were out. In order to save this unique person that had volunteered for it, that was highly motivated, that wanted to be one, toward the end, later on, we came up, this is after the 60s, we learned this lesson too late, that okay, if a man got physically disabled or what have you, we would put him in another group and allow him to rehabilitate himself and get back in shape, so that we would not lose this valuable commodity. It was too hard to get somebody as dedicated, as intelligent as this man had to be, because on the first stage of the first 16 weeks was just the beginning. He's going to be in school for the rest of his life.
Yes, sir.
All the while he's in the team. And the training just goes on and on. Many people say, well, back in the old days it was this way, that way, and the other way. Let me tell you. The kids of today, these enlisted men going in through training today, many of them with college degrees, enlisting to be in this unit, rather than going as an officer, just to be able to get into this outfit, are more intelligent, better physical shape, have better equipment, and have exceeded our wildest dreams. When I started the team, I was enlisted with all the men from SEAL Team 2 before we went in commission. And I became the commanding officer. And I was a commando outfit. A dirty dozen.
Mm-hmm.
Among our jobs was also, between 1962 and 1962, was if we had to take somebody down, we took them down. It was assassination was part of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you, with the intensive training and the dedication to getting a man who would be in this for the whole route, how effective was training in preparing men for combat in the jungles of Vietnam?
Well, that training went on. I trained my group for a year prior to their commission. They were commissioned 7 January 1962, retroactive to 1 January 1962. And by that time, SEAL Team 2, because I was working on it on a presidential 2 priority and no one else knew about it, and I was also operations officer at QDT 21, I was already sending my people off to high altitude, low opening, halo parachuting, to jungle survival in Panama and what have you, and I was training them to participate in Vietnam. However, we came under conventional factions. And these conventional factions, where leadership took second place, was no longer the most important thing for promotion. And these senior officers became CEOs, administrators. And they were conventional. And they knew nothing about guerrilla warfare. They knew nothing. They didn't read Mao, the tongue. They had nothing to do with Che Guevara. They knew very little of unconventional warfare. So they went over there to administer a conventional system in a country that it wasn't an aggression from the north, it was a civil war. They didn't know the people, they didn't live with the people, they never sat down and ate monkey brains, they didn't get the brass band from the mountain yard, or the copper bracelet from the mountain yard. They didn't live with them. It became a junior officers, enlisted men's and junior officers' war in the early part. This is from 62 to 64, 65, say. It wasn't until 66 when we became conventional. When we became conventional, they sent the Marines in there. I put in the river patrol boat, and we started a huge escalation. If we had any brains in our head, we'd have quit this war in 19... And I'm sure that had Kennedy lived, he would have ended the war in 1965. This is one of the things that I wanted to tell you, but I don't know whether you have time for it. What led to Kennedy commitment?
Well, if we, I'm certain we'll have time at the end of the
interview
to discuss that. You mentioned, you just now mentioned that there were some differences, or say officers who didn't quite understand guerrilla warfare.
Didn't quite understand that they couldn't spell guerrilla.
And I know from reading some personal accounts of SEALs that there were often severe differences of opinion between regular naval line officers who and SEAL officers or SEALs under their command.
Got that right.
How, as a commander of the SEAL team, how could you prepare your men for the fact that they might have to serve under officers who were not going to understand how best to employ them? How tough was this?
Okay, well, let me tell you. My first order as commanding officer of SEAL Team 2, I said, I don't care who the officer is, whether he's the chief of naval operations on down. Nobody countermends my order. And this is a breach of Navy regulations. So I was willing to take that. Now, if a man worked for me, he did what I told him to do. He'd say, yes, sir, no, sir, yes, sir, right away, sir. And then ignore it and do what I told him to do. And I think he'd rather face the chief of naval operations in his wrath than mine. That was it. Now, if you read Point Man, you'll find that some of that's in there. You read, probably Brave Men Dark Waters, you'll find that I had five court-martials going against me. And it took President Kennedy to get me off of. But this is basically from whence we came. And let's put it this way. The SEAL Team 2. And I started that. We had some problems. We had Admiral Holloway was the chief of naval operations. He was a hell of a fine officer. But he come out there and he says, look, if it doesn't have wings, I don't want to talk about it. Then we had the vice chief of naval operations was Horacio Rivera. And he said, we have no business in the muddy rivers and estuaries. And with all due respect to my Puerto Rican friend from my Admiral Vice Chief of Naval Operations for Puerto Rico, I said, it was Lincoln that said, and I quote, almost Uncle Sam's web feet be forgotten at all the watery margins, they have been present. Not all on the deep sea, the Braden Bay, the rapid rivers, but also up the narrow, muddy bayous, and wherever the ground was a little damp, they have been and made their tracks. This was Abraham Lincoln's letter to J.C. Conklin, 26 August 1863. I quoted this to the Vice Chief of Naval Operations. And I said, I think we have every right. But if you can't get a battleship up a bayou, that doesn't mean that the war's got to stop being fought there.
Yeah.
Now, there's another thing that you must entertain, and so must your students entertain. I was a Lieutenant J.G. when ordered to put SEALs together. Now, don't you think, sir, under any rationalization, that makes sense, if they really wanted it to work, they would have put a lieutenant commander or above, possibly an Annapolis man.
So are you suggesting that there was a feeling within the regular Navy that they did not want the SEALs to work out well because they weren't conventional warriors?
I am saying that there was a feeling because they were not, they were lieutenants that no one had control of, and in the regular Navy, you must have a doctrine for this, you must have a doctrine for that. You must adhere to it. Now, we adhere to nothing. My men violated, knowingly and willingly, any orders except mine. Because I was willing to take the brunt. That's why I became such a renegade. And that's why my men, still to this day, in total, ask me, I talk to them all, I get something like 35, 40 of contact me every month.
Yeah.
So we're still together.
That's good to hear. Well, speaking specifically about your men, as commander and as a special warfare operator, how did you view the role of your SEALs in Vietnam? How could, did you think they could best be employed?
Well, in the first place, by the time I went to Vietnam, first they employed them, the CIA wanted them. And the CIA got a lot of them. And they employed them in the junk force as advisors. And I thought that possibly as advisors was the way to employ them. Then, when I got over to Vietnam, I found that the man I relieved, Pete Willett, had trained my men as underwater demolition team for a conventional amphibious landing. Now, that's the most ridiculous thing you could do in the bayous and estuaries of Vietnam. A conventional landing. Fine for an island like Ilo Ilo, but hell, these people melt back into the boondocks and they're gone. You'll never get them. You see, in unconventional warfare, two people that are unconventional can entertain and harass 100 conventional and trying to catch them. Multiply this by, say, 1,000 and give them a little support from the people, either for nationalism and or for fear of what you'll do to them. And you have a support system. This is exactly what took place in Vietnam. By 1965, we should have pulled out. President Kennedy, now, when I met him, I told him I didn't vote for him, but I'd die for him. And this is all part of you know, being in there.
Yeah. Well, if you believe that we should have been out by 1965,
I think that, yes, rather than escalate, I also believe that if you're ever going to, here's the way the SEALs should have operated.
Okay.
The mistakes we made was in Panama. They sent us in to grab an airplane and hold it. The State Department says, okay, take a knife and knock a hole in the tire. We want this here for the guy that's coming in. That's the State Department interference.
You're speaking about the 1989 invasion of Panama?
That's right.
Okay.
And let's face it, that's not the job. Now, if they wanted to take that plane out of there, the way it should have been done was a destroyer at the 6th Fathom curve could put one shot right into the hangar, and that was it. So they misused our SEALs in a marine-type thing. Grab the hell and hold it.
Mm-hmm.
SEALs had no business. We're a hit-and-run outfit. We go in there, we do our dirty deal, and if we do it properly, you didn't know we were there until everything blows up. We're trained to kill people, maim people, and break things. We're not there to hold things. Now, in the other place where we took the governor, we saved him, okay, that's our kind of stuff. We go in there, say, all right, governor, we're here to protect you, do or die, or whatever. You're with us.
You're speaking about the invasion of Grenada there.
Grenada, right.
Yes, sir.
This is the kind of thing that we do. Now, for us to go into Vietnam, okay, hit. Take a taxpayer out. This is what we were doing, and we did it well. All the while we were in there, and when in 1966, when SEAL Team 2 went in there, we started the parakeet operation. We got more documents and more what have you. We were getting documents and intelligence and using them. Now, when in 1964, when I was in there, I'd pick up some intelligence, give it to the conventional officers in charge. They would tell me that when I said, geez, I need this information back, they'd say, well, you don't have the need to know. I say, God damn it, I gave it to you. And you're telling me I don't have the need to know? Let me tell you about going into Cuba.
Okay.
Now, you want to read the book, Brave Men, Dark Waters, on that.
It's written by Orr Kelly.
By Orr Kelly.
Okay.
Now, when I went into Cuba, the only people that was a secret from was the people in the United States. When I locked out of that submarine with my five men, we had 2 Comar boats on our tail. We had to go under it. Our intelligence that we got from the agency, and this is from people that were on the ambassador's thing for all these years, didn't know that the water eddied. So we swam 8 hours against the tide. And then came back out and locked in. Now, I went ashore twice during that operation. During my debrief by the State Department and the CIA, when I said, well, I went ashore because this guy come down on the horse and we'd have to take him out. Did he catch my men? Because they took my weapons away from me, is all I had was a knife. They said, if I went ashore with a weapon, it constituted an act of war. So here's the games we're playing. When I got behind this guy as he stopped there and smoked his cigarette, thinking, well, it'll be spot tipped in. If you read the book, you can get all the details on it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to take him out, and I got to hold the horse. And we're going to have to swim to sea and drown it. Right?
Yeah.
During the debriefing, I said, well, when I told the story that we went ashore, and then I went ashore and found out where the guards was coming from, that we, if we were going to have an invasion, we'd have to go in there and wipe them out first, and a commando raid against them. They said, well, let's go on ashore. He says, we'll have to backtrack over that. And I said, who in the hell do you think you are to lie to the President of the United States Navy? Who are you? By what right can you do this? This is the way it was. Now, the conventional people, let's get back to Vietnam.
Okay.
The conventional people, the conventional Navy that ran that over there, the first one was Captain Drachnik that I ran into. Right after Ziem got assassinated, and I can give you details on all that, after President Ziem got assassinated, they also killed Captain Quinn, who was his Navy, Vietnamese Navy's chief of naval operations. Captain Drachnik and Captain Quinn were friends. That's the way it's supposed to be. However, when the new regime came in there, and that was Khan and that group, they decided, well, okay, our government says, okay, we don't like him, but we're going to support him. This is McNamara's stupidity and a bunch of them and his advisors. So as they're supporting him, my skipper, who was Drachnik, would not talk to him. To the new chief of naval operations. So what the hell good was he? And then on top of the other thing, they had all over the military assistance command progress was our most important product. I felt like this was I was in General Electric, where price fixing was our most important product. So when you see signs like this, when I got kicked out of Lin Yan, the Junk Division 33, I says, we were out-generaled, out-fought. They had better ammunition, better discipline. And they kicked us out of the base. He says, no. He says, we moved across the river because it was strategically a better place to be. I says, oh. We got kicked out. They torn us up. And the place they moved across the river was filled with ghosts and pawpaws, according to the FNA. So they kept going over the hill. They kept deserting. So the old man says, there is no such thing as ghosts and pawpaws. I said, well, if they think there is, there are.
Exactly.
These people knew nothing about the people that they were sent there to assist. They knew nothing about the people that they were getting ready to send people in to die for. They didn't know the Oriental, and they tried to impose Occidental logic on an Oriental mind. It does not work.
Thanks. Well, speaking from experience, what were your impressions of the Vietnamese SEALs, the LDNNs?
Okay, when I got them, they weren't worth the powder to take the bone to hell. I went out there and I said, okay, let's go out there and we'll rig some primer coordinates with hand grenades. It's one of my favorite tools for putting white phosphorus and frags on the enemy along the path. They damn near blew themselves up, damn near blew me up. I told the man I relieved, Pete Willett, if I catch you in Vietnam again, I'm going to shoot you. And I meant it. So I changed them over from underwater demolition team to SEALs. I made commandos out of.
Were you effective?
They were effective.
How long did it take for you to transform them from this sort of motley crew into effective SEALs?
Well, in various degrees, about 4 months before I really had them working good. I mean, really top. But, I also had a motley group called BFI, which belonged to the Junk Force. Because as fast as I was getting some of these men trained and they became good, the CIA was taking them away from me and using them for their paramilitary.
Mm-hmm.
So I was losing men without the ability to retrain and start a new training team.
About what year were you?
64.
64, okay.
I went over there in Atlanta right after Zeme got it in 63. In fact, Americans dead and what have you all over the place. That's why I wanted to spend some time and go into why we went into Vietnam and the coup. However, you see, President Kennedy met Zeme and he put some faith in him on a nationalism thing and figured you would need a person of his caliber in order to cement it. But Madam Nu and the new regime, they were doing everything for themselves. The people got nothing. And then on top of that, during that time just before his assassination, he went out there and wiped out a whole bunch of Buddhists, assassinated a bunch of Buddhists.
Yeah.
And when he did that, some of the people that we had trained here in the United States, in fact, the skipper of the 514th Hardcore VC Battalion, educated here in the States, went over to them. You see, our people never did realize it wasn't a communist aggression. They never did realize that this was a civil war.
Why do you think that is? That the realization
because
was...
People like McNamara and what have you knew nothing about the Oriental. They were too busy feeding an military-industrial complex. When I put the SEALs in commission, and I was taken up to the president because I didn't have equipment to operate, when I went into Cuba, I went in there. take pictures of the missile, I went in there. I had no equipment because I was being stonewalled by the bureaucratic thing. No, Mike Moran, the Butte Dive, O'Connor, because we didn't have a backup system for the AR-15. I couldn't have that. These are things I open purchased. These are things I got court-martials for. Not court-martials, but formal boards of investigation. These are the things that President Kennedy relieved me of.
Mm-hmm.
That's in R. Kelly's book, but not as much as it's going to be in mine when it comes out.
Yes, sir.
So you see, with the conventional Navy, loaded on the down roll, fire on the up roll, stand by the gun tackle, they knew nothing about the people, the ethnic background, what motivated the Vietnamese. They knew nothing about the bamboo philosophy. And they certainly never knew nothing about, for every attraction, there must be an equal or opposite reflection.
Hmm.
These are, if you're going to fight, and another thing is, they're thinking conventional warfare, and they won't listen to anyone that is telling them the way it was. I had the privilege of meeting some of the greatest guerrilla fighters of that particular area in the world, in the Philippines. Of course, they've excelled in other countries, too. But if you're going to fight a guerrilla warfare, you should learn from your enemy.
Well,
hey, Guevara.
Yes. Speaking specifically of learning from guerrilla warfare, the SEALs who returned from tours in Vietnam, with combat experience and learning more, how helpful were they to your training of new SEALs?
Oh, they're beautiful. Because they came back, whether they came back wounded, or when they came back, they had ideas. I live 30 miles from a man that designed a parakeet operation. He's going to be dead in 2 months with cancer of the pancreas. His name is Leisure. Ed Leisure. These are the people that set the stage. These are the people that the kids coming up follow. I was the leader that they followed because I broke all the rules. Today, the wheel has turned. You have, right now, you have men in better shape, better able to perform more sophisticated missions than we ever thought of, and who still know the basics, whose morale is being destroyed by a conventional Navy. In other words, the wheel has turned. We have written a doctrine for unconventional warfare. When you write a doctrine for an unconventional warfare, you don't have an unconventional warfare because you give a copy of that doctrine to your enemy. The only way we can win is to do the impossible.
And this is what the men returning from Vietnam were trying to teach.
This is what the men returning from Vietnam did teach. I want to tell you something else about the officer-enlisted relationship. During the Vietnam War, you had an officer that was in the field with his knife scraping off leeches, brushing mosquitoes so he didn't make a noise, and sitting in the water as snakes crawled past him through the night, waiting for the ambush. The officers and enlisted men were together. When that officer had 14 months experience, he could go out there and lead his men because he knew what his men had been through and what have you. Today, after 14 months of non-combat, just training drills, these same officers is going up the staff and all they're interested in is they'd rather have stripe or other stripe. So let me add to this a little bit. In today's Navy, the reason morale has gone down is that you have to be a Jack Armstrong, clean-living, all-American boy. They're not the people that changed the Navy. It was the renegades, the rogues. It was the people that dared to, that changed the Navy, that designed unconventional warfare, that had the audacity, more audacity, and the moral courage to stick by their men. Today, an officer is handcuffed by those above him to say, my man got picked up for DUI We've trained him for 12 years. He can take a submarine and walk down to any part of that ship. He can get a headshot at 3,000 yards. We put X number of dollars into him for 12 years, and now he's going to lose his security clearance because he went out and let it all hang out one night. You don't put these kind of demands on people without giving them a safety valve, and if you don't know that, you don't know men.
Well,
men will follow the march that goes forever. They'll follow me forever. Do you realize I have never told a man to do anything I had not done myself?
I would believe it, sir. Well, speaking of leadership, what characteristics did you, as the commander of SEAL Team 2, look for in officers?
Well, an officer, I look for the same characteristics I look for in my men. I don't think you have time for that. And if I went into that, let me see if I can get it. I'm still looking at maximum guerrilla warfare. Following our definitions, we needed covert operations, guerrilla warfare, incidents and activity of premeditated insurgency, psychological warfare, subversion, wars of national liberation, and unconventional warfare is all kinds of things that we taught them. Here's some of the criteria that I considered when I picked the original group.
Okay.
I want a protagonist. In other words, command us, make actors of us all. The men who engage in guerrilla warfare must be able to play any role convincingly. And I had people that I could send in to do anything. They had a good background. They were street savvy. If I sent them in to be a doctor, Gibson could pull that off. If I sent them in to be an electrician, he could pull that off. Their work experience, the more skills, the better. To be quick, learn, streetwise. Friends, how does he feel about them? How do they feel about him? Enemies, if so, why? Does he get emotional? How does he handle undesirable situations? Is he creative? Does he handle paybacks with humor? Is he sly and cunning? Present problems. Will I get worse? How will I get worse? Strongest traits. Weakest traits. Sense of humor. Why? Philosophy of life. What is his philosophy? What motivates him? What makes him tick? What does he read? Do I like him? Dislike him? If so, why? Because I dislike him. Doesn't mean that I can't learn to like him. Is he drug free? How does he handle his liquor? You can learn much about your men if you drink with him. Is he strong of character? Will this person perform? Is he a saint or a sinner? I prefer sinners. They can be relied on. Saints often can rationalize dog turds in the drinking fountain. You like my language?
Yes, sir.
What is his motivation? Psychological. What? Who does he fear? Why? Are his fears a liability? Can he control them? Can he conquer them? Loyalty. Sense of obligation. A devotion to duty. To his team. Is it deep within him? Is he mission-oriented? Mission first, last, and always. Finally, and I'm sure that there's many more, is he more apt to say go than no with a we refuse the job yet, why start now attitude? I was not looking in any of this for Jack Armstrong, the all-American boy, nor was I looking for a conformist. I wanted a non-conformist. A misled youth thinking about you would do just fine. Would he kick ass and take names? The hell with the name. Would he react to a kill without hesitation? Always a question mark until you do that. What could he forget the inbred fair play bullshit that would get him killed? Forget to turn the other cheek, you only got four. Could I train that out of it? Yes, yes, yes.
I would train that out of it. That's about pretty much the way it went.
That's quite a description. Now, the SEALs were per capita the highest decorated units in Vietnam. Everybody,
yeah,
everybody agrees that they were awesomely effective. Why were so few SEALs in country at one time? I believe there's only a couple platoons at a time when there were entire divisions with 20,000 guys around. There were, you know, so few SEALs.
The conventionals couldn't put up with more than just a handful of us because we broke all the rules. We'd ask for things. If they didn't give it to us, we said, "Hey, that's great. We'll go steal them." My influence, I think, or I shouldn't say put it that way. That sounds arrogant. The influence of my men, when they started SEAL Team 6 and they wanted to go after the counter-terrorists, who did they lean heavily off? Marcinko took them all out of my original SEALs from SEAL Team 2.
Mm-hmm.
These people was raised. They were used to their officers backing them to the hill. Hell, they were more afraid to come to me. I would back them, get them out, and then their ass was mine. They would rather almost anything than come before me and tell me that they did this, that, and the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
But always, if they tore up a bar, or they killed the wrong guy, what the hell, mistakes, you know, can be made. But if you let down your men, or you don't back one of your men, hell, if I was there, I'd kill you then.
Well, do you think that SEALs could have been even more effective had, say, entire teams been in country at the same time rather than simply one or two platoons?
No, we're not conventional. That'd be the worst thing you can do. The reason when I first designed the team, it wasn't designed on a platoon or a given number of men or anything else. I'd be given a job, and for example, when I was getting ready to go into Cuba, I had to take out a military academy, two ships, and wipe out some Comar boats. I needed to move fast. I didn't need a cumbersome gang of men or mob. If you wanted that many, get the Marines, get the Army, what have you. I didn't need helmets. I didn't need flight jackets, black jackets. I didn't want any of that. I had to move too fast. So I took 13 men. And myself. And that's what I wanted. That was enough for me to attack all my problems, move fast enough to get there before they knew what in the hell was going on. We don't dig holes and crawl under and say, okay, we're going to hold this hill. That's somebody else's job. But in the beginning, no matter what the mission was, we set the men up. When I had to get down to Dominica, and that Cuban had to be taken out, all they needed was one man. So I did it.
Hmm.
And I felt that if my men were going to be called on for an assassination, I better be the first one to do it, because I'm not going to have them do anything I had not done.
Certainly.
I don't know whether this is going to do your gang any good or not.
Oh, sir, it certainly will. Any information at all that can give us an insight into what the SEALs were made of, what your mission was, how you thought of yourself is very valuable. Let me ask you now something you mentioned earlier that you wanted to talk about, Kennedy and the United States getting involved in Vietnam. What were your thoughts on that?
All right, let me get with you. In the first place, why did we go into Vietnam? The reason we went to Vietnam was a political thing that started at the Bay of Pigs. That made President Kennedy and Khrushchev's eyes appear weak. My withdrawal from Laos added a confirmation to this weakness. The communists would have been stepping up the intensity of its dialogue for wars of liberation. And the French, they promised the non-communist Vietnamese independence once, and the communists were defeated, and the French puppets, they're defeated. Ben Phu. No matter how much men and equipment was thrown into a pot, a victory would be impossible without strong nationalist leaders. That's why, at the helm, Kennedy felt that no Din Deem was such a leader. Vietnam was a place for the West to run that what was referred to as a democratic showdown against the communist so-called wars of liberation. Now, let me tell you, we had a vaguely legitimate reason to be in there. But history has proven again and again the advantage of the insurgents. Again, I say that the fight for the hearts and minds of the people is indeed an extremely difficult thing. And when the insurgent has at his disposal, a philosophy, grab him by the balls, and his heart and mind is going to come along with him. That's what they were doing. The phrase that Kennedy came up with, counterinsurgency, in itself is a misnomer. To prevent a two-man insurgency would take countless men, hours, and should they have mental support. We covered that. But what I'd like to do is our commitment to Vietnam.
Okay.
Other problems prevailed. American aid forced greed and political instability. Politics took precedence over military stability and nationalism as far as the Vietnamese went. Americans, both civilian and military, were unqualified. They were unschooled and unable to comprehend the intricacies of this type of war. You couldn't talk to them. You couldn't explain anything to them if it wasn't in the book. And I've always felt that books were made for people that couldn't think. They were completely ignorant of the indigenous people, their beliefs, their language, their customs, and they persisted in trying to impose our logic on the Oriental. The Men of Steel Team, too, had been in country in an advisory status since 1962, the very beginning. They indicated that this war would be an enlisted man's and junior officers' war. And that's what it was. It was the junior officers and the enlisted men. The more senior officers could not be risked in the field and would not understand the plight of the peasant. Involving stupid rules of engagement and McNamara's body count was another one, would inject unworkable and unpractical guidelines on the men in the field. The success of an operation, if you go on an operation, you had to plan it with your counterpart, and if you planned it with your counterpart, you was walking into an ambush. So all my missions was, while on a training mission, I encountered this, that, and the other thing, so that was my way of getting around it.
So the South Vietnamese weren't very reliable as far as...
Oh, hell no. My counterpart, the officer in charge of the LDNN, never went on an operation with me.
Huh.
You see, they had a system over there that was military and political. You had to belong to two of them in order to go ahead and get your whatever, and you get in all the coups and what have you. Ignoring the conventional warfare warrior's council and the statistician's body count is what you had to do. There were other complications when unqualified officers seized the opportunity of command to advance in rank, enabling them to achieve their bird of thought. Now, there's another thing that really comes in here, and it says it's really bad. Because as long as you had people like Drakmic of MAG saying progress is our most important product, you came up with embellished reports that were not true. And then you had people like Buckler who was writing lessons learned in Vietnam on embellished reports. This gets people killed. You know, getting back to why Vietnam, I was delighted when Admiral Ward led a successful blockade against Khrushchev in 1962. The end of 1963, they say we had less than 700. When I was over there, I was under the impression we had 450 in-country American advisors. Who the rest of the 300 was, I don't know. They weren't out in the field. Now, of note, the Geneva Accords has been approved continuously by the Congress, and I think that this is one of the things that you ought to do. Check the Geneva Accords. Get rid of all the reasons why and just check it for approval. Because they've been continuously approved by the Congress of the United States since 1954. We haven't been involved with the South Vietnamese withdrawal from the North, and we did have an obligation to support them if you really want to bend the rules. Although realization that the politics and the posturing of the two main rivals, and that's the United States and the USSR, both changed the words to justify this test for the hearts and minds of the people. Basically, that's what got us in there.
Mm-hmm.
You want it, I could go further into intrigue, brotherhood, and treachery of the new regime. If you have the time, I'll do that. You're not interested in that.
Well, no, actually, I am. I just don't want to, I don't want to keep you on the phone too long. If you think that is important, by all means, please do. As I said before, it is not possible for us to have too much information, only possible to have too little.
Okay, well, I'm not going into it, but I'm just going to touch on it.
Okay.
It was intrigue, and it was the brotherhood of all those people, the Oriental, that convinced me to declare martial law, knew, accepted the assignment, he also ordered raids on the Buddhists. The siege planned in August of 1963, the generals, they were cutting each other's throats. Each one wanted to sit in the driver's seat. It wound up with a pre-dawn flight through the subterranean tunnels, a speeding car to a Catholic church, a desperate attempt to negotiate a settlement by the new brothers, and he met his death in an armored personnel carrier from the Catholic church. And that ended the regime. That's for the final hours of Zane and his brother, Sue. I was told that Captain Lung shot the two brothers and that two soldiers with him are said to have stabbed both men several times and detained it. The Oriental is, throughout history, has the ability to be cruel beyond belief. And white doesn't really mean that much in their self-seeking and what have you. When we try and match wits with the Oriental, we're coming out second best. Because we, with our code of conduct, with our military-industrial complex, with lobbying taking precedence over the needs of the men, I needed the Emerson Lung. I would have accepted the German Dräger. We were on a Buy American kick. And the rigs they gave me when I went into Cuba fell apart. My men coated their lungs with Farallime, and I said if any of them died, I was going to kill one Mike Perez. And that's in the book. But I want you to know, McNamara's apology for Vietnam does not bring back the lives lost between 1969 and 1973. Because we killed Americans between that time without getting a better deal. And I feel very strongly, use the SEALs for the guerrilla hit and run to harass an enemy behind his line. But if you're going to commit one man to a war, be it the Gulf or any place else, make sure that we go into that war to win. And I say the only way we can win is an unconventional, I mean, not an unconventional, but unconditional surrender. Now, we were worried over there about what Russia might do or what Russia might not do. Was worrying about that after we committed them, worth the lives that was lost, the main bodies, the people in wheelchairs. Being a SEAL, you've never heard a SEAL from Vietnam cry. We've always done our thing. We wanted to do our thing. We lived to do it. But we didn't tie in with the conventional. The closest we ever came to conventional was those wonderful people that flew those Hueys and gave us the air support and close support and come in and got us and picked us up when no one else would come near us.
Yes, sir. I understand.
It took 17 days and nights across the Kamau Peninsula because my Vietnamese LCI did not come to pick me up.
Huh.
And again, every time, if you're like me, every time you go to sleep, you snore. Every time you snore, they wake you up. You're one tired mother by the time you get through.
Yes, sir. Certainly.
I know that you know my cousin Edward.
Yes, sir.
Well, tell him what you think.
I will, sir. I want to thank you for this interview. It's been very useful. It's going to be very useful to the students this semester and the next couple semesters, I'm certain. I will get these tapes copied and transcribed as soon as possible and have them sent off to you.
Just because I say it don't mean it's right. You can put that in there, but all my men thought I was right.
Yes, sir. Speaking from a personal standpoint, I think you are also. I've only begun my research into Vietnam, but everything I have discovered, you seem to confirm and ring true. So, well,
Vietnam won't function properly unless it's open.
Yes,
however,
sir.
If you leave it open, somebody's going to come along and dump a bunch of garbage.
Yes, sir.
Have a good day.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Bye now.
Bye.